The Lucas County Council Podcast is a co-production of WGTE Public Media and the Lucas County Council Program, with generous support from an Ohio Attorney General's Office grant award. More information at causakids.net.
Welcome to The Power of One, the Lucas County CASA podcast, where we explore how just one caring adult can make a life-changing difference for a child in the welfare system. I'm your host, Andrea de la Roca. Today, we're diving into how CASA volunteers can help children with special needs succeed in school. Our guest is attorney Brianna Stephan, an expert in education law and a passionate advocate for children with disabilities. We'll talk about individualized education plans, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, and Section 504 of the Rehabilitation Act. We'll also explore why this knowledge is critical for CASA volunteers and how it can help children achieve their educational goals. Did you know that nearly half of CASA volunteers in Ohio report advocating for children's educational needs, from tutoring to special education services? That shows just how vital volunteers are in this space. Brianna, welcome to the show. We're so glad to have you here.
I appreciate you guys having me. Yeah.
Let's start with you. Can you share a little about your background and what led you to focus on education law and advocating for children with disabilities?
Sure. The statistic you read off actually doesn't surprise me, because that's kind of how I ended up here in the first place. I was in private practice doing mostly domestic relations and juvenile court law, working with families on divorces, custody cases, all on the private side. But I was looking for a shift to focus more on kiddos instead of the parents in that equation, and found the CASA program. So in working with CASA and going through the training and starting to take cases and work with kiddos who had been removed from the home, I discovered firsthand that a lot of these kids had education issues. And in sitting at those IEP meetings and going to those schools when kiddos were in crisis, I got acquainted with education law and that type of advocacy. I decided I wanted to do it as a full-time job, which led me to Advocates for Basic Legal Quality, their education practice group, and now their medical legal partnership for children. So it is what I do all day long now.
How long have you been there?
I've been with ABLE for almost a year now, and it's been an amazing experience getting to advocate for kids exclusively, specifically on education issues.
Okay, so what is one experience in your work that really shaped how you think about children's rights in education?
I can think of a couple cases that I've had where their access to education meant everything to them and the family. So when we talk about kids with disabilities, or we talk about kids who have come into care and their whole world has been disruptive, that connection to school, those supports that are supposed to be happening at school, become all the more important. So I can think of a couple of cases I had early on as a GAL, as a CASA, where kids were being put out because of the behaviors, because the trauma that they'd experienced from removal in the home, whatever was going on in their life, was so significant that they were no longer able to access their education or even function in that school setting. So getting calls from a school as the school is trying to de-escalate some very, very extreme behaviors, and showing up to see that happen and play out, was a very powerful experience. Because if you put the right supports in place at school, it can be the stability for that child. Mm-hmm. It can make all the difference for them.
Yeah, especially because the children spend so much time in school.
They do, yeah. So yeah. Some of those relationships that they're forming with their peers, the staff there, the administrators, can be very significant to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What keeps you motivated in this challenging area of child welfare?
I like advocating on behalf of kiddos directly. I think that is where my efforts are best spent, and that's the most meaningful thing that I could possibly do with my time.
Let's talk about the laws CASA volunteers should know. For those who may be new to these, can you explain what the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act is and what protections it provides to students?
So education law is one of those fun areas where we have lots of acronyms. So IDEA is how you're going to commonly hear that referred to, Individuals with Disabilities in Education Act. The IDEA offers protections for students with disabilities and guarantees them a free, appropriate public education, which means it's at the public's expense, it's individualized to that individual student, and it comes at no expense to the parent. In terms of protections, these are the protections that are available to students that guarantees them access. It guarantees them inclusion to the maximum extent possible. It guarantees them evaluation for special education services, and it guarantees them that IEP, that individualized education plan. Getting there can be a process, but those are the general protections that come from IDEA.
How does an individualized education plan, or IEP, as you mentioned, work, and what makes it different from a 504 plan?
So an IEP is a little different than a 504. They're two separate things. We have a couple of different laws that apply in this particular area. The IDEA is one of them. 504, Section 504 under the Rehabilitation Act is another. The ADA, the Americans with Disability Act, is the third. IDEA is meant for students who require a modification of the curriculum. It's about changing what the student is learning to allow them to access their education. When we talk about Section 504, it's more about an accommodation. It's about changing the environment and adapting that environment to allow the child to learn. So when we talk about these different types of education plans that are available, we're talking about, are we modifying curriculum, specially designed instruction, or are we creating accommodations and changing the environment so that that child can better access their education? When we are doing something like an IEP, there's a very strict set of procedures and policies in place that the school must follow for getting that plan in place, for doing the evaluations that inform that plan, and for developing it in a way that's going to work for that student. 504 has its own set of requirements, but they are not nearly so particular because we're talking more just about modifying an environment, not about modifying curriculum, if that makes sense.
Yes. What should CASA volunteers know about how schools determine eligibility for an IEP versus a 504 plan?
So when we're talking about IDEA and we're talking about an IEP, we're talking about special education. To qualify under IDEA for services, a student needs to have a recognized disability, and IDEA lists out 13 different categories of recognized disabilities. So those could be anything like ADHD, it could be autism, it could be a traumatic brain injury, it could be a speech impairment, it could be visual or hearing impairments, it could be any number of things that fall within those 13 categories. They need to have that disability, and that disability needs to impact their ability to access their education. There needs to be an educational impact. That qualifies a student for special education under IDEA. The qualifications under 504 are slightly different because under 504, we're not necessarily modifying curriculum. We're worried about accommodations in the environment. Under 504, we're looking for a disability. And that's defined as any mental or physical impairment that substantially limits any major life function, which is a lot of jargon. Mm-hmm. Basically means it's any impact from a disability in a major life area. A major life area can be breathing, it can be learning, it can be concentrating, it could be walking, it could be any number of things. So qualifying under 504 is a little bit simpler and straightforward for students than under IDEA.
Okay, so it's safe to say that a lot of the CASA children will qualify for that if our volunteers know how to navigate the environment ask for it.
Exactly, and that has very much been my experience, okay. Is that we see these kids coming into care and they either already have the 504 and IEP in place or they're somewhere in the process of being identified, what we call child find, as a child with a suspected disability.
Why is it important for CASA or GAL volunteers to understand IEPs and 504 plans?
So one thing with kids coming into care is they are in a moment in their life when they're experiencing a lot of disruption. There's a lot going on with these kiddos. In terms of school, we can see that come out as behaviors. We could see that come out as disengagement with the curriculum. A kiddo who was getting straight A's is suddenly failing. We can see them getting excluded from school, facing suspensions or removals because of big behaviors or school avoidance, any number of issues. When that's happening for these kids, it's important that as an advocate, you're able to help them in any way that you can. And missing the school component of it is missing a whole important area of supports that are available to this child. And the school has that obligation to support that kid. So you as an advocate can step in where maybe the parent is worried about case plan services, is busy doing something else, where the caseworker is overwhelmed, and be that advocate and be a compelling advocate in terms of who's sitting at that table in the school advocating for supports and services.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I know for those meetings, if the parents are involved, I mean, there's nobody advocating for the child when those decisions are being made. So.
And that's always the concern, because the school has its perspective on what a child needs and what supports are appropriate. And sometimes the mental health provider is involved. The guardian ad litem or the CASA has a different opinion. Sometimes the physician, the pediatrician, has a different opinion of what's appropriate for this child. And if you're only getting one of those perspectives, you're not going to develop that individualized plan that this child needs. You need input from everyone, including the parents, to get to the bottom of the appropriate supports and education plan that's going to work.
So in the Ohio CAS evaluation, nearly half of the volunteers reported advocating for educational needs. What stands out to you about these, and how can CASA volunteers make the biggest difference in the child's school experience?
I think the scope of the education advocacy that needs to be done in this area is astounding. I think the report really does highlight and emphasize that fact. And that matches with my experience personally. I know there's way more kids who are in need of that advocate than advocates are available. Mm-hmm. So for CASA staff, I think it's important for them to understand what their role is in education advocacy. It's not necessarily about knowing the ins and outs of IDEA or 504 or ADA or being the attorney who's specialized in that area. That's not always what's needed. It's having the advocate at the table to speak up, to ask the questions of the school, to make sure they're fulfilling their obligations. That really counts. You as the CASA aren't supposed to be the professional sitting at that table who understands this stuff. You're just supposed to be there to ask the questions of the professionals who are at that table, to make sure that the questions are being asked, that decisions are being supported with the proper data, to make sure that the concerns you have for kiddo are being heard and understood by that staff and documented appropriately.
So school struggles overlap with trauma, foster care moves, or instability at home. What are some red flags CASA volunteers should watch for that may indicate a child needs extra support or special education services?
So there's a couple of red flags that we tend to see over and over again for a possible education issue. If we see kiddos who are frequently being put out of school, and that could look like parents getting calls on a regular basis, or the foster parent getting calls, or the CASA getting calls from the school on a regular basis, saying, Johnny's just not doing well. I think we need to take a break, take him home for the day. It could be more formalized removals like suspensions or expulsions. Those are indicative of an issue. It could be a little less formal than even that. Kiddos coming home and saying, I'm spending more time with the janitor in the hallway or in the principal's office than I am in my classroom. That removal from the education setting is indicative of a bigger issue. It could be a kiddo who's falling behind grade level. You're getting test scores back for this kid that are showing a grade level or more behind academically. That is a concern and something that would indicate a possible learning disability. If a kid is having to have the curriculum modified informally for them. So teacher, you're sitting down to parent-teacher conferences and teacher saying, oh, Johnny's lovely to have in class. He's doing well. I am having to reduce the number of problems he's doing relative to his peers, but he's getting there. He just needs a little extra support. That extra support and needing that modification is also indicative of a larger issue. Wonderful that teacher is addressing it appropriately, but still need to go through that formalized special education progress to really get to the root of what's going on. Any of these, and then some, because every child is unique and every case ends up being unique, is indicative of a bigger problem. The removals, though, especially for CASAs and the issues that we tend to see in that arena, is going to be the biggest red flag. If a kiddo is being put out of an education setting on a regular basis, that pattern means something more is going on. We need to take a closer look at that point.
Okay, so who should they speak to first? As a CASA volunteer, who do they go to first?
The school is usually a good option. So getting in touch with the school administrator and say, hey, I'm hearing from foster parents or I'm hearing from parents that Johnny's out every other day, isn't staying in class. I'd like to schedule a meeting to talk about this. That is my first step. And hopefully you got an administrator who's on board. Absolutely. Let's schedule that meeting in the next 7 to 10 days. We're going to sit down and talk about what's going on with Johnny and what we need to do. Okay. That's the start of what we call the evaluation process.
My name is Evelyn Darcy. I'm a court-appointed special advocate, or CASA for short. I was introduced to CASA because during my forensic psychology program, there was a sentence in one of the chapters that said CASAs can be amazing for children in the juvenile court system. And during COVID, I couldn't get any other internship opportunities, but the CASA office is always looking for volunteers, so I signed up for the next training session. So recently, one of the little boys that I serve, he unfortunately has been in and out of school, and he had gotten to the point that he was very proud that he was failing school. And so I had a little heart-to-heart talk when I was visiting him, and I said, "Oh, you know, why are you, like, proud of getting an F?" And he was, you know, saying, "Well, I never go to school, and I'm proud of it." And I said, "Well, wait, look at all these ways that education is good, and, you know, Miss Evelyn did a master's degree, and now I can do this." And he's like, "What? That sounds pretty cool." And so now every time I go visit him, he has to show me his 100% papers from school, and he always has, like, a present of one of his A tests, and I'm super proud of him. CASA shows you the worst in people, but it also shows you some of the best things in people. And it's rewarding to see that this time that you put into the kids and the next generation, you're breaking and abuse cycles. You're showing them there's a different way of life, and hopefully giving them tools to excel where they didn't have them before.
According to the Ohio CASA Evaluation Report, children with CASA volunteers are more likely to receive the services they need. That shows the direct impact volunteers can have when they advocate effectively. Our volunteers often share with us that building relationships with schools can be tricky. How can CASA volunteers effectively collaborate with teachers and administrators while still advocating for the child?
I think a lot of time at these IEP meetings, there's a lot of frustration. Nobody knows quite how to help this kid, or we're dealing with teachers and staff who don't have the supports that they need, who are dealing with however many more kids that are in their class and not receiving all the resources and support that they would love to give the students, and it creates a very frustrating situation. So we can have a lot of adults around this table who can, by no fault of their own, lose sight of why we're there. They can lose sight of the kid that we're actually talking about and what our goal is in being at that table. I think it's helpful as an advocate to reset the balance for everybody, to remind them that we're here to help, you know, this student succeed, and that is our job as professionals, as adults in this scenario. So as sympathetic as we are to teachers who do a very, very difficult job, sometimes it's reminding them in a very polite and appropriate way that we are here to talk about Johnny and what Johnny needs, and to offer that constructive input on how we do that.
I had experience with that, going to those meetings, mm-hmm. and you are completely correct. Like, sometimes they lose Or they're so frustrated with the parents, mm-hmm. because they feel like if the parents were more involved, the child will not be in that situation. But
we see that all the time, where instead of, we'll see school staff getting frustrated because they don't feel supported by the parents at home, which they feel is perpetuating the issues they're seeing at school. But there's a flip side of that, that no matter what parties are involved, whatever the deficit is, whether it's on the parent side or the school side, we never want the kid to be the one to suffer for it. So whatever everyone's issue is, the fact remains that school, you've got an obligation to this child. That's what we're here to talk about, because the child's not going to be on the losing end of the scenario. That's where having that advocate at the table is so important. Is they're the one who makes sure it comes back to the fact that the kid is not going to be losing out here for whatever reason.
Okay, so once you reach out to the administrator, mm-hmm. the teacher, you go to the appointment, you talk, you both realize that something else needs to happen. What's the step? Like, how long it takes for a child to get to, now I have an IEP and they were giving me all the resources I need to succeed in school.
In a perfect world, if we're talking about IDEA and a child ending up on an IEP, that should take about 90 days, maybe a little more, depending, is the very lawyerly answer.
Okay.
Because when we're talking about the IDEA, there are very specific procedures for how an evaluation progresses and how an IEP is developed. And there are requirements for the time frame and everything else that happens during that period, which requires the request to be made, 30 days then for the school to hold a planning meeting, which involves whoever the teachers, the administrators, the parent has to consent. An advocate like ACASA can sit at that table, where we choose what evaluations are necessary for us to figure out what's going on with Johnny. How do we get to the root of this behavior or this suspected learning disability? What evaluations do we need to do to figure this out? That all happens at before the 30-day mark for the planning meeting.
Okay.
We then have 90 days to complete all of those evaluations and get back together as a team to sit down and go over what we call the ETR, the evaluation team report.
Okay.
And then if we decide at that evaluation team report meeting and looking at all of our data that the child has a disability and likely needs special education, we're going to go forward and hold an IEP meeting and develop that actual education plan for the child. All of this has to happen before the supports go in place and kiddo has an IEP that's helping them work on goals.
So CASAs out there, if you have school-age children, you need to be aware of how they're doing at school and if there's a need to address it as soon as possible.
My advice, the best piece of advice I can say, is to get in touch early with the school. As soon as you suspect there's a disability, as soon as you suspect there's a problem, contact that administrator. Say you want to hold an IEP meeting. You want the team to meet to discuss this child's needs and discuss the possibility of evaluating them for special education services. The sooner you make that contact, that referral, it's going to trigger the school's child find obligation, which will start this process rolling. Getting that process started early makes the process go forward quicker and easier.
Yeah.
The sooner we do that, the quicker we can get the supports in place to help that student.
What common mistakes do you see well-meaning volunteers make when trying to navigate the education system for children living in foster care?
I think with CASA staff, and I am guilty of this too, is we can be very empathetic people. And we want to work well with everyone and appreciate their perspective and understand where they're coming from when they're saying things. So when we sit down at the IEP table and we're faced with teachers who are truly trying to do the best with what they have, administrators who mean well but are missing the mark, there can be an inclination to be sympathetic towards them and very understanding about where they're coming from and their frustrations with the situation such as it is, that we can lose sight of what our role as the advocate for the child is in that scenario. It's so important for CASAs to remember that their job is to get what their kid needs. So while there is an appropriate way to work with the school administration and their staff, our job remains unchanged. We are the advocate for the child. Our job is to get that child what they need.
Can you share a few strategies CASA volunteers can use to help children not just get services, but actually thrive in school?
I think when it comes to getting a kid what they need in school, understanding that child is key. So going through that evaluation process, getting the information from the assessments, getting more assessments if those initial evaluations didn't give you the information that you need, looking to other partners that we have at this table to get information about the kid. Sometimes there's a counselor involved. Talk to that counselor. Find out what the counselor is recommending in the school to make sure that the kiddo can access their education. Talking with Board of DD workers or High Rise workers, anyone who is having contact with this kid and might have insight into what's going on with them, leverage that information in order to get them the appropriate supports. I think firm advocacy is helpful in this scenario too. I think knowing what it is that you believe is going to help your child, walking into those meetings with those goals in mind, and then following up after the meetings in writing with the school to show that this is your position, this is what you are requesting as the advocate, is very helpful. A lot of time as an education attorney, I will hear from advocates who have been sitting at these IEP meetings with the family or with the kiddo for however many months. They've been making the arguments, they've been pushing back, they've been advocating for certain supports. But when I get the education file, what I see is the school's narrative laid out in the documentation only. So when we're getting those, we call them PRO ones, because
acronyms in special education are, you know, necessary for everything. PR ones, prior written notices, that document anytime we make a change to the child's education. We see just the school's concerns documented. We see just their narrative in these documents. So a year down the road, when I get it, I'm seeing just the school side of the story. Something advocates can be doing at any stage in the process is formalizing their concerns in writing, formalizing their input in a way that's going to be a part of that record. It's going to be part of the narrative that lives on in that student's education file. And that can be a compelling thing later down the road when we go, if there is a need for further litigation, if an attorney mm-hmm. does have to get involved on the education side.
Yeah, so just like anything, you need to understand the language they're speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Because you can say, make sure you add my comments to your narrative.
And that's a great phrase. Yeah. Can you note that in the PR01? Can you note our disagreement or my concerns about Johnny's not having a one-on-one aide at gym class to help him participate? Whatever the concern is, please note my concerns in the PR01. Or, I don't know that I understand what you're saying to me. Can you break that down in a way that I can understand? Like I said, the job of the advocate is to sit there and make the professionals at the table do their job. So if you're walking away with questions or uncertainty mm-hmm. or not really understanding how we got to Johnny being removed from this classroom and suddenly being in special education all day or whatever the situation is, then the school hasn't done its job. Mm-hmm. And you as your advocate haven't done yours because your job was to ask the question. Why are we proposing a change of placement? Why can't we add more supports in the classroom to make this work for Johnny? Whatever the case mm-hmm. may be.
Yeah. And again, the CASA volunteers, we are the voice for the child. We should be understanding what is happening. So if they want to know, because, you know, the older children want to know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You're able to explain it to them in a way that they can understand. So if you cannot understand it, then you
chances
need to ask
they
questions.
Don't either. Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
And sometimes there's an opportunity for older children to sit at that table, too. And you as the advocate can advocate for them being at the table to talk about their own education services. It's not always appropriate for every age group or every disability, but if you have a student with, say, ADHD who's in high school and wants to sit in their 504 or IEP meeting, that's absolutely appropriate. They deserve to be at that table if they want to be.
Thank you. Those are great strategies. Now, let's take a few minutes to talk about the school and child welfare systems. What changes or improvements would you like to see in how schools and child welfare systems work together to support children with special needs?
So one area of advocacy and one concern that I have had is under the Every Student Succeeds Act, it's ESSA is what we call it. There is a requirement when a kiddo comes into care that a best interest determination be made about where that child is going to attend school if they come into foster care and have to move, or if they get their placement changed and their school of origin is maybe no longer the most convenient choice. There is a best interest determination about where they attend school that is supposed to be happening. It's been my experience that decision is being made by default. That it's a question of convenience and not about what is best for the child in terms of whether they continue to attend their school of origin where they've been attending or if they start attending in their placement.
Mm-hmm.
What I would like to see happen is for the communication on the agency side, the welfare side, and the school to improve in such a way where that determination is happening in earnest, where we're actually considering what is best for this child amidst the other disruption in their life relative to their education. And we consider whether that is staying at their school of origin or changing schools at that point.
Yeah, especially if they already have an IEP.
Mm-hmm.
Those teachers know this child and the specific needs. So if the child goes to a new school, they're dealing with that too, plus a new culture, new classmates.
Precisely. And that's further disruption for the child. And mm-hmm. it can be a disruption of the educational services.
Mm-hmm.
So if we have the appropriate supports for a child in place in their school of origin, a very tailored education plan, or even a gen ed student who's doing perfectly fine but has friendships and rapport with the staff there, that additional disruption can set them back academically, behaviorally. And that's not always what is best for that child.
Mm-hmm.
Might make sense logistically. But what is best educationally is a different question. And I want to make sure that question is actually being asked.
What's one piece of advice you give CASA volunteers who may feel intimidated by the complexity of education law?
I think the best piece of advice is advice I was given early on as I was learning this area of law, and that's that you are not supposed to be the professional here. Sitting at that IEP table, sitting at that 504 table, your job is not to know the ins and outs of these laws or the particular procedure that's in place. That is the job of the school professionals. That's why there is a whole team that is required from the school side to be at these meetings so that they can explain it to you. Your job is to listen and ask questions.
Brianna, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and insights today. For CASA volunteers, understanding education law isn't just paperwork. It's a pathway to helping a child thrive academically and personally. To our CASA volunteers, your advocacy in school can make a real difference in a child's life. If you're working with a child who might need extra support, take the time to learn about IEPs, IDEA, and 504 plans. And remember, your voice matters. And ask the right questions, too. Brianna, where can listeners learn more about your work or get resources on education advocacy?
If they want to go to ablelaw.org, we have information available both for parents and advocates regarding the fairness in education and accessing education. We have a bunch of pro se resources like example letters that are available to those who are interested in using them in their communications with schools.
Thanks again. And to our audience, thank you for joining us today. If this conversation has inspired you, we encourage you to become a guiding light for children with special educational needs who are living in foster care. Learn more about the Lucas County CASA program at casakids.net. Again, casakids.net, or call us at 419-213-6753. 419-213-6753. Until next time, I'm your host, Andrea de la Roca.
The Lucas County CASA podcast highlights how the power of one person can transform the lives of abused children in our community. This podcast is a co-production of WGTE Public Media and the Lucas County CASA program, with generous support from an Ohio Attorney General's Office grant award. All episodes are posted on WGTE.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Learn more about the Lucas County CASA program at casakids.net.